Good afternoon. My name is Evan Bleicher. I'm a development manager at Progress Software. The team that I work for, the core client team, is responsible for the maintenance and enhancements of the ABL language, as well as support for the ABL runtime engine, or the ABL virtual machine, the AVM. We also support all the client configurations that you utilize, the batch client, Terraform client, GUI client, GUI for .NET, the open client infrastructure, Java and .NET, as well as the open client, as well as the Windows-based deployment facility and runtime engine web client. Additionally, we work with other teams within OpenEdge. For 11.4, we're working with the database team on support for table partitioning, and we're working with multiple groups within OpenEdge to roll out the next set of mobile capabilities. For this year's PUG presentation, I was asked to put together a presentation that summarizes all of the language changes that we have introduced in the 11.0 timeframe. That includes 11.0, 1, 2, and 3. Additionally, I have some slides that provide a quick overview of what we are providing from the language perspective in 11.4. I'm not covering things like table partitioning, which are covered in other sessions here at the PUG. Instead of providing these features in a chronological order, I group these together by the functional area. The agenda is listed here. Given the number of features that we'll be talking about, I do not go into depth in any particular one. All of these are released pieces of functionality. You can check our online documentation or training material to get additional information. Additionally, there are a number of people from the core team here today who would love to talk to you about any of these features throughout the PUG. So, let's get started. So, in 11.0, prior to 11.0, we supported inheritance for classes. So, a class could indicate that it inherited behavior from another class. But if you're doing polymorphic programming, you didn't have a similar capability through interface files. So, in 11.0, we addressed that limitation by augmenting the interface statement to allow you to specify that this interface file inherits from zero or more other interface files. Any class that implements this interface file is obligated to provide method definitions for all of the methods that are defined in the interface file, as well as all methods defined in all the interface files that this file inherits from. This allows you to do polymorphic programming through the interface file. Additionally, we modified the typeof function and the isa method. The isa method is a method off of ArgusLine class to also understand this interface inheritance. We extended and expanded our dynamic access capabilities. In 11.0, we provided dynamic access to properties. And 11.3, we provided dynamic access to our built-in objects. As we continue to expand and provide more capabilities in the ABL, we are exposing many of those new features as built-in objects. A number of them are listed on the bottom half of the screen here. In 11.3, we provided the ability for you to dynamically instantiate those classes. We'll have more on both of these topics over the next few slides. So, prior to 11.0, you could dynamically instantiate a class. You could dynamically invoke a method, and that was it. In 11.0, we added the ability of dynamically getting property values, setting and getting. You do that through the dynamic property function, as well as through the reflection class, progress.lang.class. There are two methods on that class, get property value and set property value, for providing that functionality. As I mentioned previously, prior to 11.3, you could not dynamically instantiate any of our built-in objects. So this screen is in three different segments. At the top part of the segment is we are instantiating a JSON object through the nuke method. Or additionally, you can do it through the dynamic new function or through the reflection class using that new method. So there's now consistency as of 11.3 to our capabilities of whether you're instantiating one of your own OO classes, or whether you're instantiating one of our built-in classes. your facility is the same, your capabilities for is the same. We received feedback from customers that when they were programming procedures, there was a benefit that they experienced by being able to specify that parameters for the procedure could be specified as being like either a database field, a temp table field, or another variable. But that capability did not exist for methods and for user-defined functions. So in 11.1, we augmented that syntax to provide that capability. So here's an example of a method that is defining its three parameters via the like phrase. We strive to make the OOADL consistent with other object-oriented languages. We reserve the right to provide our own behavior if that is something compelling in via the ADL. There was a compelling reason why the ADL had to be different from other object-oriented languages. In 11.3, we observed that the way that we implemented private data members, access to private data members, and access to protected data members was inconsistent with the way that other object-oriented languages worked, and that was not our intent. So, in 11.3, we modified our behavior for the way that you can access private and protected data members to make it consistent with other object-oriented languages. How did we change it? What was the change that we made? So the ADL, prior to release 11.3, we reviewed private data members. I'm just going to talk about private data members for a second. We reviewed those as being instance private data members, which means that only when you had a class and you instantiated it, only that instance of the class had access to the private data members. If you had any other class in your application that had a reference to this instance, it could not, the compiler would not allow, the runtime engine would not support access to any of the private data members. Other OO languages view this slightly differently. They say, well, the private data members are really type private, which means that if you have another instance of the same type, and that second instance has a reference to the first class, through that reference, that instance of the class, because it's the same type, can view, can access, can modify the private data members of the other instance. So we've gone from a instance private model to a type or class private model. The same is true for protected. So that was a quick summary of the changes we've made to the OOADL over the 11 time frame. And I am going to take a see what's going on here. This seems to be in automatic mode. So in 11.0, we introduced, we expanded our support for JSON, serializing data as in a JSON format. Many applications, many ADL applications, serialize their data as XML. JSON is another data interchange format. It is lighter weight. It does not have an XML schema. And as more and more applications use JSON, we've extended and expanded our support for it. So in 11.0, we introduced a number of built-in classes to support the serialization of data as JSON. Just a quick primer on JSON, there are four different simple data types listed here, and and two different complex models, object and array, are our complex data elements. So in the ABL, we introduced two built-in classes. They are listed here. The JSON object class is utilized for accessing the name value pairs that constitute a JSON object, and they are syntactically in JSON enclosed by braces. And we also support a JSON array object that is used for accessing the unnamed array of array data in JSON. I'll just give you a short example of what JSON data looks like. Here is an example of some JSON data. It shows two JSON objects, sales rep and tractor sales. Sales rep has three simple data types associated with it, and tractor sales has three arrays. Through the objects that I just mentioned, you can programmatically read and write this data very effectively in the ABL. We also support methods on our Pro data set, which allow you to either read in XML or JSON data and populate a Pro data set, or temp table, or to serialize a pro data set or temp table as either XML or JSON. We have methods that our ability to look at XML data, we look at the schema to determine if that schema represents a valid pro data set in the ABL. Over the release of 11, the family of releases for 11, we've extended what kind of schema and what kind of inferred schema we can get from the data we will accept as a pro data set, allowing you more easily read data, either XML data or JSON, and have it automatically populate to be a pro data set. Also, based upon feedback from customers, we modified some of our methods, like write JSON, to provide additional capabilities. Here's the advertisement portion of the presentation. Robin Brown is having a session tomorrow at 4:45, where she is going to cover XML and JSON in depth, which I'm not doing here at all. So if your application utilizes, or you want to take advantage of XML and JSON, go tomorrow to Robin's presentation, and she will guide you through that. The next section is just a quick overview of a number of language elements we've added to the language for different reasons to based upon customer feedback over the releases. So, at Exchange, there has been feedback that customers wanted the pause statement to pause for less than a second because they were scripting things and they needed it to wait for a smaller unit of time. So we've modified the pause statement to not take an integer value, but take a decimal value, allowing you to pause for any unit of time that you feel is appropriate. Our technical support organization wanted additional information, your application may need this as well, about what version of the client's running. So now you can get very detailed information, the major, minor, the major version number, the minor, the service pack, the hotfix, the build number of a particular client, if that is what you need. Application programmers know that if your code uses UI elements, if your ABL application has graphical elements in it, depending upon how you compile that application, that R code needs to run on that particular kind of device. So if you have UI elements and you compile it through our GUI client, the R code will get flagged as being GUI R code and has to run in that environment. Some customers wanted the ability to inspect a piece of R code to know whether this .R file was tagged as being a GUI, needs to run through the GUI system, is a character mode piece of R code, or whether it's agnostic and can run on either device. The ABL supports the ability of calling an industry standard web service. The model that we have used since the introduction is that we support calling a web service as long as it supports SOAP 1.1. A number of customers logged issues that they were needing to invoke a web service that supported SOAP 1.2, and they were unable to do that from the ABL. So we modified the ABM to support calling both a SOAP 1.1 web service and a SOAP 1.2 web service. There are additional attributes that SOAP 1.2 supports that provides you, and we have augmented some of our objects, the server object, the SOAP fault header entry ref object, the SOAP fault object, so that if your web service provides that data, you have access to it from these built-in objects. Just a reminder, we're supporting pulling up a web service that utilizes SOAP 1.2. This is not providing the capability that when you expose your ABL application as a web service, we're still only supporting SOAP 1.1 in that environment. We extended and expanded our support for our structured error handling capability. When we supported structured error handling, we created a statement that you could put at the top of your compilation unit, at the top of your .p or class file, and it was called routine level on error undo throw. And what that statement did was it said that every routine level block in this compilation unit, whether it's a procedure, a method, a user-defined function, I want any error that occurs within that block to automatically undo the block and throw the error to the caller. And the reason we had to add that statement was that there was no syntactical place within these routine level blocks for you to add an error directive telling us what to do for that block. Well, some customers really enjoyed, got value out of the way that we did structured error handling. and wanted errors to be thrown not just from routine level blocks, but from all blocks. So we created a new statement, block level on error undo throw, which changes the behavior of each and every block that does not explicitly have an error directive on it. So that means all routine level blocks and your repeat blocks, your core blocks, your do transaction blocks, will automatically now undo an error if it occurs within that block and throw the error to the caller. And so now they do not have to laboriously put the on error undo throw directive in every one of these blocks. For those customers who found it onerous to put the block level statement in every one of their compilation remits, there's a startup option. And so you use the undo throw startup option, and any file that the compiler compiles while this startup option is in play, we will insert either routine level or block level statement into every file that we compile. So we've made it very easy to add these statements, but you're still obligated to respond to the errors appropriately. So you still need to go into your program and figure out where those errors are getting thrown and catch the appropriate error and do the right behavior with it. So rounding out the 8-bill changes, we continue to expand our support for Unicode. There are places in the application in the ABL where we read data from disk. A number of those statements are listed here on the slide, input from, output to. And there are a number of times when an end user might provide your application with this data. And up to this point, it has always been that these files had to contain only ASCII data. The real use case, we've had several errors about printer names only supported ASCII characters. And so for those customers who that was not the natural way that end users would have named their printers, that might be a problem. So in 11.3, we modified the way that we open up files so that now the file names can contain any Unicode character. The same is true for printer names.
Is that a configurable option?
No, it's not configurable. The question was, is that a configurable option? No, the ABM was modified so that it will do the right thing with the data that you provide.
I'm using that behavior right now.
You're taking advantage of the fact that we do not support.
Yes, I am.
Wow. We'll talk later.
Okay. Come back.
Come back next year and you'll see a startup option. No, you won't. Okay. So the next modification that we made is we support single run and singleton paradigm. We'll talk about those in a second. So, when you run a persistent procedure on an app server, doesn't matter what model the app server is, when you run a persistent procedure on an app server, a couple things happen. That particular app server agent, right, gets bound to the client for the duration of that persistent procedure. So as soon as you run a persistent procedure on an app server, that agent that it got dispatched to and that client are bound. Meaning that if any other client tries to run something on the app server, there's one less resource available to it. Additionally, the communication between the client and the app server to run a persistent procedure, run an internal entry, internal procedure in it, and then delete the persistent procedure requires three messages to go from the client to the app server. I'm on some kind of automatic thing here. Anyway, here we are. So we modified that in 11.2 and 11.3 such that we made that model more performant. We did that by doing two things. We introduced single run and singleton, which we'll talk about in a second, but by doing that, we reduced the number of messages from 3 down to 1, and we also make it such that the app server agent is no longer bound to that app, that ABL client, to that client, excuse me. How did we do that? So instead of running a program persistently, you now indicate that you want to run it either single run or singleton. Let me talk about singleton for a second. When you mark a procedure as being singleton, and you do that via the run statement, so where you used to say the word persistent, you now say singleton. When the ABL and the ABM sees that statement, it does not send a message to the app server. It simply notes that internally. If your application then goes on to run an internal procedure in that singleton procedure, it's at that time that a message goes from the client to the broker to find a particular app server agent and runs the persistent procedure, the singleton procedure at that time on the app server, running the main block of that .p. It is a requirement that your main block not take any parameters. We then run the internal procedure inside that persistent procedure, get the output parameters, if there are any, and return it back to the client. At that time, that app server agent is no longer bound to the client. If another client happens to run another internal entry in that same singleton procedure, if that request happens to go to the same agent, the agent will know that it has already run the main block of that singleton procedure. It will only, therefore, just run the internal entry, the internal procedure returning the data to the client. The advantage here is that that singleton procedure will live from the first moment it was instantiated through the life cycle of that app server agent. Once it is created, it lives for the duration of that app server agent. If you take the same scenario, and instead of saying singleton, run foo.p singleton, but say run foo.p as a single run, the communication is exactly the same, it's just the life cycle of that procedure on the app server that changes. Now, each time an internal entry is run, a internal procedure is run in that single run procedure, the main block, that instance is shut down, we create a new instance, we run the main block again, run the internal entry in it. So it really depends upon how you want to instantiate your procedure. If you want the main block to always run before your internal procedure, single run might be the right model for you. If once you instantiate it, run the main block, every internal procedure in that .p really is an independent unit, singleton might be the right model for you. But all of this requires the fact that your client or your app server do not need to maintain context.
So singleton would replace the current persistence?
So does singleton replace persistent? Well, no, it does not, because if your application requires there to be context, right? I need this agent to be bound to the client because I'm going to set up a whole bunch of stuff and I need to know I'm going back there, then that might be your model. If you can pull away from that and have it so that there's no state information, well then singleton will be more performant for you. Next section, our support for Win64. Never practice a presentation with rehearsed timing again. That's what I learned here today. So 11.3, we added support for a 64-bit Windows client, GUI client. So what does that mean?
Gotcha.
Hold your plug. prior to 11.3, if you installed the 64-bit OpenEdge products, you got a 32-bit version of client. But now with 11.3, you'll get a 64-bit GUI client. And what's the advantage of a 64-bit GUI client? Well, you can access just a ton of memory, with 8 terabytes, but not the 2 gigabytes that a 32-bit product supports. So there's some potential misunderstandings about this. What does it not mean? Well, if you have a 64-bit Windows box, does that mean it only can run a 64-bit application? No. Windows 64-bit machines support running 32-bit applications and 64-bit applications. Is it necessarily the case that a 64-bit application is more performant? Well, no. It may, but it's not necessarily the case. And is it the case that your program, your GUI application, will automatically plug and play in this new client configuration? And unfortunately, the answer is no. And let's talk about some of those challenges now. So on the positive side, Progress Developer Studio, your editor, your application development environment, is supported on both Windows 32 and 64. That's a really great thing. Your R code that you generate, right, R code is portable between 32-bit and 64-bit environments, so that's really great. There are some install limitations. You cannot install both a 32-bit client and a 64-bit client of the same OpenEdge version on the same Windows box. That is a limitation that we're looking at eliminating, but as of 11.4 when it comes out, limitation will still be there. We changed the imaging package that we use as part of the 64-bit client. It supports the image formats noted on this slide. These are fewer image formats than the 32-bit product, but these are all the common ones that the business application will utilize. We have never received feedback that people are using other image formats other than those. Moving along, so where are some of the compatibility issues that you might run into? A 64-bit version of Windows has to load, can only load, a 64-bit DLL, cannot access a 32-bit DLL. So if your program is using a 32-bit version of a DLL and you port to the 64-bit GUI client, you need to get access to a 64-bit version of your DLL, which either means you're going to build it in something that you built internally or go to your VAR and get it from your VAR. But besides getting the 64-bit DLL, you have to look at the code that you have in the AVL that invokes the routines inside of the DLL. You'll need to potentially look at the way that you're passing parameters, whether the integers are now longer, whether the pointer values now are 64-bit, not 32-bit. So you have coding changes that you'll need to do in that area. Additionally, if you use OCXs, it is probably the case that there is no 64-bit version of the OCX. I can't say that categorically. It is the case that when we ported the product, we internally used a number of OCXs, and our success rate of finding a 64-bit version of them was limited. So there's places where we had to recode depending upon what OCX we used. If you're using GUI for .NET, you're using .NET assemblies, the Infragistics assemblies that you can get through OpenEdge, those are built in a way, it's called AnyCPU, which means it can run either on a 32-bit or 64-bit platform, which means you will not have a problem with those. Our experience has been that most vendors who are creating a .NET assembly seem to build them using AnyCPU. That's it for Win64. Diagnostics. What did we do on diagnostics? We modified, application programmers told us that when they're using temp tables in their application, there are times when they have questions about, my DBI file keeps on growing, I'm not sure how many temp tables I currently have in scope, I know I have a memory leak somewhere, but I'm confused as to where to even begin to look for that information. How do I get access to some information? And the way that we address this is by introducing virtual system tables for accessing information about temp tables. So for those that are familiar with using VSTs when they want information about a database table, it's the same concept, it's the same VSTs. In fact, it's actually a subset of the VSTs that are supported against database table because not all the VSTs are appropriate for temp table. But we've introduced some built-in classes that allow you to access these VSTs for temp tables, and through those VSTs you can get some information. So the built-in class is progress.database.temptableinfo. It's a mouthful, but through that built-in object, you now get information like the number of temp tables that are in scope. You can find out which procedure or class instantiated the temp table. You can get access to the temp table handle and other information. So here's a small snippet of code that uses the a class temp table info, uses the attribute temp table count to find out how many temp tables are currently in scope, has a loop that accesses data for each one of them, and returns to the caller information about that temp table. You can also access VSTs and start to get the very specific information that the VST provides you about the temp table. Additionally, we modified our enhanced logging capability. We now log additional information about temp tables. We log when it was created, when it was deleted. You can read this on the slide. Empty temp table when bound and unbound. You'll also get a count of the number of records and how big those records are. So additional information is available to you through logging as well as through the VSTs. Performance. This is performance changes that the ABL made, the ABM made. In 11.0, we created a feature that is called delayed temp table instantiation. We noted that when instantiating a procedure or class, we instantiated all of the temp tables that you defined in your application, even if it was the case that through a particular application flow, execution flow, you may not ever access any of those temp tables. So we were instantiating objects internally that potentially were never utilized at runtime. Additionally, we spent a lot of time building up those temp table data structures internally. So now we delay the whole process of instantiating temp tables until your application actually utilizes that temp table. And that, depending upon your application, can have varying performance improvements, but it saving the execution a lot of work when we do instantiation. The Rocket team, the database team, has always has supported for a number of releases the ability of doing a table scan. The SQL team took advantage of that. The AVL did not until release 11.0. So we eliminated that oversight or that, we now provided that capability. So now on the for each block, you can indicate a table scan. What does that mean? If you are accessing every record within a table, and you do not care in which the order in which we retrieve that data, you can indicate that you want to do it via table scan, which means that the Rocket team is not going to use an index to navigate to each record. This means it will be more performant. In the example I used here, you're simply summing up the values of a field in every record on the temp table. And by doing that, you can do that in a more performant way. We made a whole bunch of when we did our R code version change right in 11.0, we do R code version change at major releases. So when we did our major R code version change, we took that as an opportunity to modify some R code so it's more performant, and there's a whole bunch of internal changes. We took an opportunity to remove some limitations. One of the limitations was that we would allow you to use .NET objects that supported UI controls, but if the .NET object didn't support UI, we did not allow you to utilize that in your .NET application. In 11.0, as well as 10.2.0.2, you now can. By supporting non-graphical .NET objects, we've enhanced some of our clients, the batch client, the app server agent, the web speed agent, the character client, so they also can take advantage of these non-graphical .NET objects. We have these statements, we call them IO blocking statements. They are, I think it's 8 of them. And you cannot use these statements prior to release 11.0 in a number of places. You cannot use an IO blocking statement in a user-defined function or a non-void method, which is a pretty easy rule to remember, I guess. But the problem really comes is you can't even use them in a void method if a non-void method is on the call stack, which is very confusing and very hard to program. And so we took an opportunity to remove that restriction from the language. Now you can use IO blocking statements in any of these places, and there is no restriction anymore. From time to time, we introduce new warning messages because we're adding new capabilities or based upon feedback from customers. Other customers call us up and say, wait a second, my program used to compile clean, and now it gets this warning message, what's going on? So if you don't like the warning message that you see, you can suppress it. You can either suppress it by using a list, or you can tell us to suppress all warning messages, and life will be good again. And then we just changed the maximum values that supported on some startup options. Dash INT was increased, lock wait timeout was decreased to new parameter values. Oops. So, in about 40 minutes, because my timing said that I did it in 40 minutes, we walked through 11.0 through 11.3 from a purely language perspective. Now, here are some slides about what's coming in 11.4, the standard disclaimer slide, things may change. So, if you were participating with us during the development of 11.4, all of the features that I'm going to discuss right now were provided to our community through the Early Software Access Program. And it was through this Early Software Access Program that we were looking for feedback from you about the features that we were providing, how we were doing them, kind of the capabilities that we were exposing, looking for feedback from you. It is late in the development cycle for 11.4, but we will continue to utilize this methodology moving forward. And so I encourage you to get on to utilize the ESAP program and to give us feedback. Because getting your feedback early in the development cycle is just is great for the team, and it really will get a better product out the door. The features that they're talked about briefly, they're kind of mentioned. One was mentioned in the opening session was object OO serialization. We also introduced get class, before image for JSON data, and a 64-bit web client. So, object serialization. Up to this point, you could not serialize OOAVL objects between an app server and an AVL client. This caused challenges in a number of different ways. One way is that you couldn't throw an error message, error object back from an app server, and you couldn't pass information that was encapsulated in objects between a client and an app server. That was modified by providing based built-in capabilities in the ABL. So now you can throw OABL objects, you can pass objects between an app server and a client, you can include objects in the temp table and pass a temp table between an ABL client and an app server. The next step was things that we're going to provide in the future. So prior to 11.4, if you attempted to throw an error object from an app server back to a client, you got a warning message in your app server log file. Error was raised on the ABL client, but none of the contextual information was available to you. And if you tried to pass an OO object, you got a runtime error. In 11.4, we support both those capabilities. You can throw an error and you can pass an OO ABL object between an ABL client and an app server. In order to do that, however, you have to opt in to object serialization. You need to mark your class, actually all classes in your class hierarchy, as being serializable, or else the ABM will not consider that object serializable. When talking about object serialization, really there's a sender and there's a receiver. It doesn't really matter just whether the ABL client is sending something to the app server. There's a sender and a receiver in that relationship. So what does the receiver do when it gets the data off the wire for object serialization? It recreates a new object instance for that object. All the data is passed by value. It is not the case that the receiver has a pointer back to the sender's object, which means that whenever the last reference to the sender's object reference is deleted, that object on the sender's system will get garbage collected. The ABM will garbage collect when the last reference goes away. So there are now two independent objects. They have their own life cycle, and they're going to get deleted by the system whenever the last reference to each one of them is deleted by your application. Both the sender and the receiver must be 11.4, or the original error conditions I just mentioned are enforced. What data gets serialized? We serialize all non-static data members. That's non-static variables, properties, pro data sets, temp tables. It does not matter if it's public, protected, or private. All of that data is serialized. We did not provide a mechanism for you to indicate that all of that's fine, but I don't want you to serialize that particular value. That's something that we're considering for a future release. When we acquire the data for your properties, we do not call your getter for the property. We simply take the value that is associated with that property and we send that to your receiver. If you have a mem pointer in your class instance, we will serialize the mem pointer and all of its data as long as the ABL was the system that allocated the memory for your mem pointer. If you used a DLL for shared object, we do not serialize that data. If you have handle-based variables, handles to widgets or buffers or queries, we will serialize the opaque ID, the ID, but not the underlying data. So it probably, no, not probably, it has no meaning to the receiver. It is only really there for a round-trip message such that if an object comes back to the sender, that opaque ID is still valid. What do we not send? Well, we're not sending any kind of state information about that object instance. So things like, what is the contents of the buffers at the time I did my object serialization? What files do I have open? What strongly typed events have I subscribed to? All of that is not sent as part of object serialization. We've simply serialized the non-static data, as I've mentioned before. Not all of our built-in objects are serializable. There's documentation describing which ones are not. And you cannot serialize a .NET object or a hybrid object, something that inherits from a .NET object. Here's the syntax, and here's the new keyword that we added, serializable, which you have to add to your class definition, noting that this class is serializable. When we want to instantiate that new instance, a couple things. We do not run the instance constructor. An instance constructor is run when you want to start an object from the beginning, But we're not. We already have all the data associated with that particular object instance. So we don't run the instance constructor. We just fill in that object with all the data that we got from the sender. We do run the static constructor because we didn't serialize any of the static data. So the static constructor is run again, and now I have an instance on the receiving side. Through all of this conversation, we've talked about data, not about R code. So it is the case that the sender and the receiver both have to have the same class on both sides of this communication. Thank you. So, classes are on both sides. Do the classes have to be the same? Well, sure, but what does same mean? So same means that the signature of all the methods and the number and data type of all of the data members has to be the same. And the way that we do this internally is we have a MD5 value, we have a computation that,
hash
value, thank you, of all of the method signatures and data members. It does not mean that the R code has to be exactly the same. So if you were to insert some code in a particular method, we don't care. It's just that the signature and the data members has to be the same between the sender and the sequence. And as I mentioned before, you can now have a temp table with a field that's a progressLine.object that is defined in class, and you can pass that between a client and an observer. So at last year's exchange, and I believe the exchange before that, people identified that when using the reflection class, and he's in this room at this time, when using reflection and you call the get class method, the parameter to the get class method takes a type name expression, which means it could be a character expression, which means the compiler has no idea what you're passing to it and doesn't validate anything. And there was a need so that the compiler would validate and other things, I'll talk about that in a second, the name, the type name that you wanted to get the type information about. So we introduced a new built-in function called getClass that doesn't take a type name expression, but takes the type name, so the name of a class, so foo class, foo. If you don't specify a fully qualified class name, we will do our standard thing about using the using statements to figure out where this class is and use a fully qualified class name. The compiler will also validate that this class exists at compilation time, allowing you to have a strongly typed facility for getting type information. Rounding out the presentation, we modified JSON before, with JSON serialization of ProDataSets. So now if your ProDataSet contains before image data, we can serialize it both as XML or as JSON, and that before image data will now be part of your serialization. Once again, attend Robin's presentation. We also introduced a 64-bit web client. So now you can indicate that you want to deploy your application to your end user site. You can indicate whether that it's a 32-bit application, a 64-bit application, or both. And you can do whatever works for you in that context. So my slides tell me that I'm done. And that's what we have.
So questions? The machine.
One more time.
Any questions?
I have a language question.
You have a language question. The language team is sitting right there. So, sure, what's the question?
Why is accept changes now required for every do block?
Why is accept changes required for every do block?
A rhetorical question?
That is a rhetorical. Now, the pause.
On a data set.
No, just the do block.
I do not believe
every
that.
Every time I type do, I get accept changes.
That's PDSOE.
Yeah, that. Yeah. You're talking about in the tooling. Yes.
It's actually a design question.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good question, long presentation.
I was going for the quick kill, but.
I think that is it. So thank you all very much.
So,
I just need 1 second to figure out what the heck I did wrong. Willikers.
You probably have it.
I can tell you now there's actually a guy in the back that had a copy of your remote. He was doing it.
Why? I would believe.
Right.
So I rehearsed the timing. I didn't realize that
it was spot on in a couple of places. You turn around and touch it, they would already be there.
I rehearsed too many times what it means. But, all right, thanks a lot.
Oh, it was great. That bit kept it, you know, light, funny and light.
There you go.
You wanted to hear about my ASCII support scenario.
I don't even know.
Purely happenstential of two pieces. The first piece.
What?
That couldn't be 45.
I think next career move is going to be ASCII.
Okay. No, I just forgot. Oh, that makes sense, because I'm sweating like a pig. I can't.
It's my fault. I didn't bring back the microphone.
No, that's okay. I sent my scouts to hunt you down, and so...
I was almost sure I left it with the face.
You know what? The only thing that would be worse is if it was on, and like, we could hear you throughout the building. That could be awkward for everybody.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks a lot. So
here's my question.
What's your scenario?
The scenario is this. It may not apply to you, but I think it does. I've got huge ASCII files that I've been sending to a database. One of the things I discovered is the fastest way to get to the last line is to do a copy log.
What?
Okay, cool. So we're
copy log. Yeah.
If there was any. What I found out was if there was any non-ASCII characters which should not exist in the file, I would get an error.
So this might be a copy log failure. Hold on a second. So you're saying
so I thought this was kind of in the same scope. Maybe not.
We'll talk. So if you have. You're doing a copy log.
Okay.
Which means what's your source and your destination of your copy log?
Copy log.
Laura, listen to this.
Copy log is the source.
No. What's just a copy means between a source and a target. What's your source?
The source is a ASCII file.
Okay, so a copy log from a file.
ASCII file to a long chart.
Okay.
So
file on one side, long chart on the other.
Right. Okay. And I was using that to get to the last line so I could find out how many, because the last lines tell me how many records I'm supposed to have.
The last line of the file.
Of the file. So that was cool.
How does CopyLob tell you the size?
No, he's just saying it's in the file.
It's in the long chart.
Okay.
And it's in the file.
Yep.
Okay, so we had a problem where we were getting lines merged when we were doing the import, one line at a time.
Yep.
And the reason was there was corruption in the file in that there was non-ASCII charts. And it was actually skipping lines and merging them.
But I would assume that it...
Hang on, okay. Let me finish the story.
Yeah.
Okay, so when that case happened, it so happened that my copy log was throwing an error, which was great because then I could trap the error and say,
I can help you non-ASCII.
We have a problem, okay? And tell the user that we're going to do something with this file to convert it. So then I basically sent it to a TR command, and the TR command cleaned up the file, but I still was letting the user know that we've done something with this file.
All right, so hold on a second. So
you have to worry about that.
Yeah, right. So let's talk about this. So when you're doing a copy log from a file to a long character,
right.
We didn't do code page conversion as part of a copy log, correct?
Right.
And we're going to code page convert between the code page of the file, which is going to be CP stream, to the code page of the long car, depending now if the car low is long car been fixed code page or is it in CP internal? Well, it depends. If it's code,
I don't know that. I don't know the answer.
Okay, so we're going to do a code page conversion from CP stream to either CP internal if there is no code page right with the long car, or if it's a fixed code page to the code page that it was fixed to.
Right.
And if the data element that is in that file, well, it depends if there's no code point for it. If you're going from code page A,
if it's code page A,
you can't convert it.
Right. But I was happy with that. I was getting an error. I was trapping the error, and then I knew
we
that
I had
encryption to file and I fixed it.
Nothing I just said.
No,
okay.
We haven't changed that.
Okay.
You co-filing is all about the file name that you put. And all that kind of stuff.
How I understood that bullet was that now there will be no error raised if I'm doing any kind of input.
I don't know for sure, but copy log from file to something. Now you can have Unicode filing in the file string that you put in the statement. That has nothing to do with
it. It's not going to make my failure go away.
Sure.
Thank you.
No.
Because I'm used to being a failure, and I want to retain
it. It's just being able to use Unicode filing.
Okay, all right.
And probably copy log is one of them. I can look at the documents. I think the files are in Unicode. It's all about the file name. It's not about the file itself.
Okay.
Right. So, it's not going to break. So.
This is good.
This is interesting.
Hey, Laura.
This is Tim Cooper.
Quick notes.
Hang on.
So I'm just trying to think here. So Tim wants to know about every language element that is coming in, let's say 11.3. So we added a keyword serializable. We add a statement get class. We add all these language changes. We're all hither and yon. I'm just trying to think of where we might summarize all of this. So we have the NERF, the new and revised feature document. Does the NERF contain each and every keyword change? I don't think it does. No. So.
Every feature that would contain a keyword.
Well, not necessarily the feature, but not as a
purpose. Yeah. Because I worked on Digital Equipment Corporation back to BMS a long time ago. And every time we upgraded when they upgraded their Fortran component, Digital Equipment Corporation released a list and said, listen, here are the keywords, things we changed.
Well, we have a keyword list. Right, the AFL has always supported.
But it's okay, we've done the same thing ourselves.
Okay, so there is a keyword list that identifies both reserved and unreserved keywords in every release. There's a file in DLC bin, is it not?
N-E-W-K-Y-W-D.
Which is the new keywords that is added.
What about the blue one? Do they have the one or the
and you can diff them.
You can diff them. That's where you get the keyword
files.
Forget
yes.
First.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Because the new one says for 11.4 would be the only ones that are added for 11.3.
Correct.
Between that and 11.3.
Correct.
Or it's a list of both.
Yeah. Correct.
So then the difference in the two would be the ones that are different.
And you use that to be able to get things compiled. What's the name of the
I think N-E-W.
K-W-D.
N-E-W-D.
N-E-W.
K-Y.
WD. No tension.
No,
and then right?
It's in under the
something like
or something like that. And then there's going to be like a R10. I don't have any install on my machine anymore.
And then it's in the progress record, right?
DLC.
It's in DLC somewhere.
DLC like bin.
And that's what people use to when things don't compile because they have words that become new keywords.
Yeah.
They use that to be able to forget.
So there's your microphone.
Yep.
Do you need anything else?
Nope.
Okay.
That's something similar.
Thank you.
We have one of the editing tools. Before we use PDSO, we can just work on it.
Thank you. How's it going?
All right. Bluebird, right?
Huh?
Bluebird?
No.
No.
Delano Valley.
That's right. Flores.
Yep.
So did you guys ever get any further? We were talking about redoing one of your websites.
We got a little bit further, and then management decided this wasn't important, this is important.
No.
Sort of the squirrel scenario. Yeah. You understood exactly what I meant, so it's...
I get it now.
We have a business case for squirrel.
Yeah, exactly. We're starting to relooking at it. The big thing we're looking at right now is mobile.
Yeah.
And we're finding more and more of our customers are asking for a mobile solution than the rewrite of our website. So we're actually into what technology we want to use. You know, do you want to use, you know, Appio or Infogistix or ESTJS or, you know, Progress's mobile, you know, app
yep.
technology. And then once you decide on that, then what technology do you want to use behind it? Whether it be XML, JSON, REST, web services. So we're in the information gathering design mode right now as far as what we want to be able to provide.
Yeah, Tom hasn't asked for them yet, but usually about midway through, maybe the second day,
he'll be asking Tom for them to get an email a week or two out and say they're available in 1 month.
Tom will be emailing, asking him for slide decks, which hasn't happened yet.
Well, you know, it's